Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome back to the Pilgrims Podcast, the most exciting podcast on the internet. And we're vaguely on schedule. We might be a little bit late this week again. We should probably make this a bi-weekly thing, because I'm pretty busy and you're pretty busy, and I have to kind of keep writing this stuff.
Bi-weekly means twice a week.
Oh, does it? You know, because I've heard both. I've heard that, like...
Bi-monthly.
No, well, what about once every 2 weeks? What would you call that then?
Bi-monthly.
Bi-monthly?
Every other week?
Well, but what if you have, like, 5 weeks? Well, I mean, yeah, I guess it would still be twice monthly. Well, anyway, recap.
I can write them. I can write.
Promises, promises. So, last week we were talking about the X-Files.
Kind of,
yeah. Well, me and Mom talked about the X-Files. We did get a comment from Mr. Sala about something you mentioned. He said the Leonard Nimoy show in the 1970s was called In Search Of.
That's right.
He says, I think the national interest in UFOs was fanned by the book In Search of Ancient Astronauts and the stories in the National Enquirer and all the other tabloid offshoots. You have to remember that these were pre-internet days.
Dark Ages.
Yes, the Dark Ages. How did people cope? How did people find out things without Google?
We had something called the World Book Encyclopedia. And guys would go around from house to house peddling Funkin' Wagnalls and World Book Encyclopedias. And they'd sell you these, you know, 28 volumes with annual updates, plus a geography edition or something like that. And if you were like me, you'd sit in the living room on when you didn't have anything else or when you were homesick from school and flip through World Book Encyclopedias, looking at the pictures mostly.
Man, that sounds like a life.
Yep, those were the days.
Yeah, you know, it was clickbait kind of stuff.
So you haven't changed very much.
I'm right there. That's right there. Yep. I would look up kittens and puppies mostly.
Yeah, those little Jesus pictures that you have to share or else you're not really a Christian.
And I'd flip back and forth one page to the next, and I called that a GIF, you know. And then I'd cut something out of the newspapers and tape it underneath, and I'd call that a meme. A picture in the encyclopedia. So yeah, I was cutting edge.
Well, anyway, Daryl also mentioned that he was talking about one of the episodes in the new season of The X-Files, Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster, which is probably the best episode of the show. I mean, of that season. Well, definitely of that season, anyway. And he mentioned that it was originally written by Darren Morgan for ABC's 2005 revival of The Night Stalker, which showed the continuing adventures of investigative journalist Carl Kolchak. You can see the script from 2005 here if you have any doubt, and he has a few links. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard that somewhere, I think. I can't remember exactly, but, yeah, and in fact, one of the characters in that episode is actually dressed like Kolchak. He's got the hat and all that going on for him. He was also very funny. He's played by a Kiwi actor. I cannot remember what his name was now, though. Rhys Darby, I think? Rhys Darby? I don't know.
He was made out of kiwis?
He was made out of kiwis, yeah. That's how they make
fruity
them.
Meat.
Yeah. So, anyway, that was a good episode. But today, we're going to be talking about...
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Well, we'll talk about that, too, because it kind of actually falls a little bit into the topic which I was going to cover, and we just finished that movie, so we might as well. We're going to be talking about heist films and kind of escape films, just, you know, things that are a little bit lighter, sort of in the middle there. I think we should probably start by if we're going to go about this in a little bit of a historical way, by talking about Raffles.
Oh.
So if you're going to talk about anti-heroes and
Bunny.
Thieving anti-heroes in particular, you got to start with Raffles. Now, Raffles, Arthur, I don't remember what his middle name was. Arthur James Raffles, Arthur something or other. That was a series of short stories written by a fella named Hornung. E.W. Hornung. And he was Arthur Conan Doyle's brother-in-law. And he kind of wrote it as somewhat of an inversion of the Sherlock Holmes dynamic. So Raffles...
Which is what brother-in-law would do.
Yeah, yeah. And Raffles is a master jewel thief. He's pretty much the first gentleman thief to be really wildly popular, and he's got his bumbling sidekick named...
Bunny.
Bunny Manders.
Bunny Manders.
Bunny is not actually his name. It's actually Harry, but they call him Bunny.
He's a hairy bunny. It's been a long day.
Yeah, my mom is very good at the... She's bringing the mom joke game tonight. Oh, gosh.
I'm tired. I can't help but...
I'm going to miss this so much when I head off to school. Yeah. Okay. Raffles. We ran into Raffles by watching the old TV show from the 70s with Anthony Valentine and Christopher Strawley. Those were a lot of fun.
Who's your buddy on Twitter or on the...
I sent Christopher Strawley. I had never sent, I don't think, anybody fan mail before, but I couldn't track Anthony Valentine down because I'd had a crush on him. And I wanted to send him fan mail, but I couldn't find him, so I had to send it to Bunny instead. And I mean, you know, not that I really would have had a crush on either of them anymore, because they're both in their 70s, which is depressing.
Raffles is no longer living.
Yeah,
right?
he died a few months ago, and I wrote an obituary on my blog, But yeah, that was a fun little series, just pretty lighthearted stuff, and fairly faithful to the stories. It was not as dark as they were. They could get rather grim sometimes, that would have been your first I think anti-hero, perhaps heist type story that you would get, at least coming from Britain, but on the other side of the Atlantic, you had other stuff going on. You had not gentlemen thieves, but con men and that sort of thing. And I haven't really looked into that. So anyway, my first question would be like, how does the tone of a heist film alter from that of a murder film? You know, do they often intersect, and do those genres ever intersect? You know, would you say that? Yeah, just what were the differences?
Crickets.
I love you guys. I don't know. I mean,
heist films like what? You're going to have to give us some examples.
Okay, well, say...
Because I haven't seen that many.
Well,
I think.
The Sting.
Well, I've seen that.
And Waking Ned Divine. And
they're kind of like Robin Hood, right?
Yeah.
It's like... Robin Hood, which is that somebody's... It's like Bernie Sanders, only, you know, as a ninja. Because he just wants to... He just wants to make every... You know... He just wants to take from the rich and give to the poor. Right? And he's kind of a socialist thing. So it appeals to everybody's socialist instincts.
There we go. Yeah. The socialist instincts. Well, I guess my question...
I mean, that's assuming everyone has a socialist instinct, which is probably not true.
I think that Daryl probably has no socialist instincts at
Daryl
all.
Daryl doesn't, but you know, they're so good at painting the, you know, the capitalist or the banker or the fill in the blank, the wealthy, oppressive entity, whether that's an individual or a bank or whatever, that, oh, it's only justice for them to be taken to the cleaners and the wealth redistributed.
I think some of it is like that. And
some of it.
I think that my favorites tend to be of a slightly different sort. Raffles, you know, that was really my next question. The first question was pretty obvious. Just heist films are going to be much more upbeat than a murder mystery or whatever, and they're just, I think, they tend to be much more fun. Always, and we're going to talk about kind of the different genres within that. We're also going to, I think, maybe talk about escape films a little bit too, because they're kind of in the same, I think, the same genre. So, but anyway, what you were getting at is how should we treat the morality of a heist film? How, you know, and how do they, because different ones, I think, handle the situation differently. Sometimes they try and paint the mark, the target, as, you know, they're just so evil that the good guys have to be, you know, or the
right.
The good guys are okay. So that's, but on the other hand, you have a lot of really good heist films that are almost a satire of their heroes. To say, look at yourself in the mirror, and this is really funny. You know, isn't it funny that these people are greedy? And not all heist films involve the heroes, or the anti-heroes, rather, getting away. And that was why I had split this up into several different genres. You have
Well, and you also have the heist films where they... you're taken from the bad guys, like in kind of like in The Sting, right? Which what was his name, Donovan or whatever? I mean, he was the thug, he was the heavy, and they took him to the cleaners.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that they went after anybody that was more legitimate.
Yeah, and I think that would be a situation in which you have, you know, you have your bad guys, but then you have more bad guys.
Right.
Badder guys, you know, so it's all okay.
Right.
And those don't tend to be my favorites, I think. You know, I think I prefer the more satiric type, you know, and I'd split it up into four different things. The first is the get away with it genre, and then the next is the reformation genre, then the just desserts genre, and the descent into darkness genre. So the first one is, these are going to be the ones where your heroes get away with it. That's fairly obvious, I guess, from the title. So here are a few examples of that. Waking Ned Divine and The Sting.
10 out of 10 on Waking Ned Divine.
Yeah, the Patriarch's a big fan of Waking Ned Divine. So what's great about that film?
Everything.
Okay.
I think what's great about it is that the whole village, you know, is going to prosper from it, you know. Everybody wants a
everybody's greedy.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
They're all kinda in it together, you know, they're gonna cheat the national lotto together.
Well, I mean, and
which the national lotto is cheating everybody in the nation anyway.
Yeah,
it's
well,
kinda like you're stealing from the bad guys.
Yeah, the Patriarch is thoroughly on the Robin Hood side in that one.
Yeah.
That's his one socialist instinct, is that, well, it's okay if you're stealing from the government, which I think is a very proper American sentiment. But I think that also that film...
I'm not serious about that, are you?
Yeah, the lotto's going to be...
Don't look at my taxes too closely.
Well, the hero of Waking Ned Divine is a fellow named Jackie O'Shea, and he's a, I think, a very typical hero in this type of film, which is he's very charming. He's immensely charming. He can talk his way out of anything. You know, just blarney. He's Irish, of course. They're all Irish.
What I like about, you know, the two guys that are kind of the, I think they're both kind of heroes, he and Michael O'Sullivan, is they're elderly gentlemen, you know.
It's very nearly the perfect movie for me.
Yep, who in a lot of cases still act like boys, you know. And as a matter of fact, Jackie's wife, when she's talking, she says, "Have you seen the boys?" You know? And so, I don't know, it's just really a fun movie. Even though, you know, we don't, of course, agree with even playing the lotto, much less cheating. But it was fun.
Well, I think it falls, and Roger Ebert commented on this. He says, well, you know, he says, stealing £7 million from the lotto is, of course, not very wicked. He said it's just a little bit of fun. But the funny thing is, too, that their excuses for why they're doing it are just so hilariously self-aggrandizing. You know, it's like, for instance, Jackie, the reason he says he's doing it is that he had a dream from in which the rightful winner of the lotto offered him a chicken dinner. And from that, he infers that obviously he needs to get that guy's earnings.
He says, share the winnings. Share the chicken dinner.
Yes. And, of course, that's just hilarious because he's just completely deluding himself.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
They also say it would be good for the village.
Yes, but if I offer you chicken dinner, do you think that means that I'm offering you all my money?
Yes.
Okay, I'm never offering you a chicken dinner.
It was symbolic.
Yeah.
It was symbolic. He didn't try to. All he had to do was say, you know, Ned told me to share the winnings. You know, no, he said this is what he's got
just enough of a conscience.
I know. I'm not going to get down on the
wheel.
All I'm saying is it's written well. It's acted well. The scenes are spectacular. The music's great. The casting's first rate. Just, I mean, across the board, it's just the pacing. I love. There's suspense.
The music.
There's the comedy. The timing and all is just spot on. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's really touching. I mean, when he does the eulogy there in the middle of the movie, it's just, you know, it's just a wonderful piece of filmmaking. It really is.
I feel like the acting, especially Jackie and Michael's acting, is very real, relaxed.
I mean, they're two guys that are both dead now, but they, you know, so it was their, I mean, they were just having fun. They were doing what they had been doing all their lives, and they were doing it very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were very comfortable with their roles, and just, they could just put them on like a suit, or in a couple cases, their birthday suit. And
that's right.
and just have a ball with it. It's just a wonderful movie. I mean, it's one of my absolute favorites. Top five.
I agree with all those things. I also think that Jackie is self-deceived and it's funny. I mean, it's just one of those things I think that we can, because he is that way, because you can sort of distance yourself from it saying, hi, you know, you're kind of laughing at yourself. You're like, oh, I've been greedy like that. I've tried to kind of twist my own imaginings into something so that I can win £7 million. I mean, not that I've actually done that, but...
I disagree on that, because it was... Everything fell into place. Everything kind of kept falling into place because... I mean, I'm not agreeing with it, but because of the divine intervention. Everything that was supposed to go on, like when the lotto guy's looking out the window and Jackie's walking by the window and he just turns his head at the right time. You know, little stuff like that. It's like it's all meant to be, and that Ned is pulling the strings from beyond the grave.
You know, I've never thought of it that way.
To make everything kind of fall into place,
yep.
So that people did get the money.
And also, Lizzie just sailing right out there in the telephone booth.
And then it's like when the priest is talking to the little boy. He's like, well, what are they going to do with it? Oh, they'll spend it down at the bar, you know?
In the pub. Fitzgerald.
Yeah, you know, and so you got, you know, 50 people or whatever it was spending $150,000 each or however much it was down at the pub for the next, you know, 40 years.
It's going to make the bartender very happy.
You know, they weren't going to start, you know, they weren't going to ruin their lives because they were that rich. They were just going to live comfortably and do what they wanted to do, which is spend time with each other.
Yeah. Well, I think most, at least my favorite Irish movies, tend to take place in a sort of magic place where, you know, consequences don't exactly exist. You know, I mean, this is a story about a pair of leprechauns trying to find a pot of gold.
Well,
you
know? That's right.
And it's funny you should mention just kind of the idea of a greater power behind everything, which I'd never approached the film that way, and I still don't think I do. But it's interesting because in my review of it, I referred to the way that it finally resolves itself as one sublimely evil deus ex machina, which just sort of an act of God, and it's hilarious because it's quite black humor. But yeah, and I also the other thing I love about that particular movie is that it's just a really spot on depiction of a village, I think. It just feels like all the people in it, you know, really feel like real people.
They do, but there's no village in the world that's like that, but you always want it to be like that.
Yeah, it's somewhat idealized, I'll admit that, you know. But yeah, that would be that's one of my favorites too. But yeah, that falls under the get away with it genre, and I think though that you can kind of make a case that it's somewhat of a satire, and I think that that's part of why I like it. But then you have ones that take the morality of the heist a little bit more seriously, and that's going to be things like and that's the Reformation genre, which I'm talking about next. So you have Catch Me If You Can, which is a Steven Spielberg film. We can talk about that in a second. And Raising Arizona, which is another favorite of ours. That's a Coen Brothers, an early Coen Brothers, kind of their first big hit, which stars Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter. Mm-hmm. One of you want to summarize that movie? Or should I?
Well.
What, Raising Arizona?
Yeah.
Well, Nicolas Cage and the lovely Miss Hunter are newlyweds, and he's got a sordid past with the police and with with crime in general. And so, when they find out that they cannot have children, they basically
decide to kidnap.
They put together a plot to kidnap one of the like quintuplets of the. Of Nathan Arizona's painted Arizona furniture.
Unpainted, I think.
And so they steal into the nursery one night and lift out baby Nathan and make off with him, and they get chased all over the daylights by young John Goodman and his cohort, and then also Tex Cobb, who was
bounty hunter from hell.
Really terrific role for him. And
didn't they have a?
Ultimately, they end up taking the baby back, but it all ends well in the end.
Didn't they have a TV show called Dumb Criminals?
I don't know.
That kind of sums up this movie.
You know, and that's watching Dumb Criminals always feels a little bit like you're watching a documentary about where we live. I just know these people.
That's why I like Raising Arizona, because it is very much like here.
Yeah, the people in it, you know, they just seem very familiar. Like my granny's neighbors, what was it? They like broke into her house and were barbecuing something when she got home.
No, they were grilling on her grill on the porch when she pulled up, making themselves at home.
Yeah, redneck life.
Can't say that on the air.
We just did.
That's a pejorative.
Yeah, well,
I have a redneck.
and I love it.
And in country, a farmer's tan.
Another example of the Reformation genre would be Catch Me If You Can, which is Spielberg. And that one was about, that was actually a true story, about Frank Abagnale Jr., who was this con man who just did an extraordinary amount of things. He could fool just about anybody into believing he was anything. He would bounce checks, and you know, made fake checks. I think that was his main thing. And he impersonated a doctor I don't think he ever had to do surgery. He almost did. And then he impersonated an airline pilot and then actually flew the plane.
And that was based, did you say it was
pre-9/11.
Based on a real story,
it wasn't,
right?
Yeah, it was a
true story.
Yeah. But
which is amazing.
The story of that one, though, was that they made it a father and son type story, and his father was kind of distant and just it had kind of this strange relationship. His father was Christopher Walken in the movie. Leonardo DiCaprio played.
Well, that would do it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't picture any non-dysfunctional relationship with Christopher Walken involved. But yeah, that was a good movie, and he ended up getting caught, I think, near the end by Tom Hanks's character. Of course, Tom Hanks is the ultimate, you know, Uncle Dad America type guy. And so that was kind of the father figure for Leonardo DiCaprio, the con man. And that was quite an interesting movie. I enjoyed that one.
Well, I listened to that book on tape, and on CD. And so I listened to like half of it, and I stopped because I don't remember exactly why I stopped, but I do remember being quite uncomfortable with the way, because I mean he really pulled that stuff off. I mean he was really like a doctor in a, if I'm not mistaken, a children's hospital,
mm-hmm.
And he was in he was like on third shift or something crazy like that, you know, and I remember in the book, you know, they called him one night. He was, you know, he obviously didn't have to do anything, but they called him one night and they said, "We've got a blue baby," and he made a joke. He's like, "Well, you know, what do you want me to do about it? You know, color, bring a different color, something like that."
I thought he said,
and it was, you know, it was this pretty, you know, serious situation, and he's, I mean, I just felt like at that point, you know,
this has gone too far.
Yeah, I mean this isn't, I mean, he was pretending to be an airline pilot, and that was basically to get a free, back then you could get on the plane, and they always kept like a spare seat for other pilots that needed to jump from one city to the other, and he had gotten into where he could pull that off, but they were also, I think, it's been several years since I listened to it, you know, they were to serve in a capacity that if something happened, you know, that they were going to fly the plane. And, you know, I just, wow, that's pretty serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's taking a lot of people's lives in your hands. And,
yep.
And not that anybody could, I mean, I know that's not, you know, most people don't do that as a crime, but just that whole fraud idea and glamorizing the fraud really made me uncomfortable. I mean,
the
Congress is full of them, but, you know.
The movie did not do that.
I'm sure
it did. I mean, it did at first. I mean, it was kind of a thing where, you know, he's pretending to be an airline pilot. That's kind of hilarious. But at the same time, there were consequences to it, and it was a pretty serious little story.
Yeah,
but it was a lot of fun at the same time. And you know how Spielberg is about father-son stories. That was one of the ones that he handled pretty well. Speaking of which, though, that reminds me of another example of the Reformation genre, Going Postal, which is about a con man named Moist von Lipwig, one of the best names of all time. And Moist he defrauds all these people, and he's kind of, you know, he considers
right.
himself to be a pretty glamorous character. And he ends up caught by the government. This is, and I'm not going to spoil too much of this, but he ends up caught, and this is happening in a fantasy universe, by the way, in a really, really terrific period drama style. By Terry Pratchett. Yeah, it's just it's a great story. It's got David Suchet and Charles Dance and just about everybody. And so anyway, he gets caught by the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, and he's hanged to within an inch of his life. The last inch is the crux of the matter, the hangman informs him. And then he's hired by Ankh-Morpork's benevolent dictator, Lord Vetinari, to restore the postal service. You know, either be hanged or go postal. And it's more dangerous than you might think, because he has to employ all of his skills to fend off homicidal competitors and psychotic employees and mountains of supernaturally vindictive paperwork.
Vampires.
And vampires. And he's also got a... parole officer, who's a golem.
That's right.
Your safety is my concern.
Yeah, that's a good one. And he has to come to grips with the consequences of his frauds, because he meets some of the victims of them, and for instance, the golem, who is a very moral character, points out to him, he says, well, you know, because you have stolen money from people, you have caused them to kill themselves and caused this and that, and, you know, caused ruin and caused... And so suddenly, just all of his...
sins.
Well, yes, his self-deceptions come crashing down around his ears. And so you have a very different genre from something like Waking Ned Devine, which doesn't take that very seriously.
Shows him the consequences. I think that
yeah, and I think that
good.
that movie did that really quite well. It reminds me, too, of Father Brown from, like, the, I guess, 50s? Yeah, it was with Alec Guinness playing Father Brown. That was a pretty good one, because Flambeau is this great detective, and I mean, a great art thief, and he and Father Brown have this relationship where they're trying to, Father Brown's trying to catch him, and he kind of mentors him, and it's quite a sweet little movie. But, I enjoy the Reformation genre pretty well, but it's you have to get it just right. Then you have the just desserts genre, which is when people get what they deserve. So with you have Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where they get, I think, cheated, which they do deserve, and it's a mad world in which they pretty much all get caught. The Lavender Hill Mob, Kind Hearts and Coronets, The Lady Killers, all of these are, you know, the villains are unredeemed and irredeemable, and it's, of course, very funny, but they can't get away with it, or else the morality of the tale will not survive intact. So they've got to sort it out in one way or another. But those are good films, too. It's a mad world. That's a good one, though I wouldn't. I don't know if I would call it a heist film so much as a chase film, I guess, you know. So, The Lavender Hill Mob, now that's a genuine heist film. That's a good one. I was on an Alec Guinness kick for a while there, and watching several of his older movies, Ealing comedies, and I recommend all of them. But The Lavender Hill Mob was my favorite, I think, and it was him and this other guy, and they were going to steal... some sort of gold, I think, from the bank, and it was really funny. Kind Hearts and Coronets, that's not a heist film, but it's a black satire about a murderer who is murdering his way up through society. That was a good one. It had to have one of the best voiceovers of all time, don't you think?
Oh yeah, I agree. It was. That was a really funny movie I've just been really impressed by a lot of those older movies that you've kind of exposed us to, and that was one of them that just really, really wicked in the wit and the writing. It's just really well done.
Yeah, and that one also is distinguished by the fact that Alec Guinness is in it and plays 8 characters.
Right.
None of which are Obi-Wan Kenobi, believe it or not. He could play other characters. Though Dennis Price is the unmistakable star of that film. Everybody talks about Alec Guinness's 8 different characters, but they're really just the background.
You're right.
Now, The Lady Killers, on the other hand, he's a pretty major part in that. That's a film about these five... con men that move into a little suite of a little apartment above this elderly lady's house. They move in with her, and her name's Mrs. Wilberforce, and she's just this tiny, sweet little Miss Marple type lady, really quite oblivious to the world, a little bit innocent. And they decide that they're going to use her in their plans somehow or other.
I wouldn't call Miss Marple oblivious to the world.
Well,
though.
I wouldn't. Yeah, she looks like Miss Marple, but she's not anywhere near as aware of human evil as Miss Marple.
But she's not as helpless as she may first think either, though.
Yes, but it's nothing on her account. It's just sort of this evil fate that goes against them. You know, near the end of the movie, Alec Guinness, he just has this haggard look on his face. And I'm not going to spoil any of the specifics for you, but he's like, there were only five of us. It would have taken 50 men to conquer Mrs. Will before us. And, oh, man, that's a funny movie. And that's a black comedy, too. It's just, this is the one where there's just sort of this evil fate going against their every move. Yeah, that's a funny one.
It's a great movie.
And so, and again, that keeps its kind of its basic moral center preserved. I forgot to mention how to make a million, how to steal a million. I think that was with Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole. I can't remember what they were stealing. They were stealing something from her father, right? Because you didn't watch it, Dad.
Yeah, I watched part of it. Yeah. It's been a long time, but I watched part because I remember her in it.
I think that they may be the...
Yeah, with O'Toole.
Like the ultimate cute couple. They're both have those kind of delicate eyes, you know? And they're both as pretty as one another. And they're extremely charming together. That was a good little movie. John Williams scored it, actually. I think that was one of his first scores. I think he was even credited as something like Johnny Williams.
I mean, he's been... Been doing that forever, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he just came out with The Force Awakens. Which I didn't... I liked as a score okay, but I thought it was fairly unimpressive compared to some of his older stuff. There's this new movement in movies scoring, which is, you know, let's not go so much with catchy themes, you know, which I'm old-fashioned. I like the catchy themes. I like that stuff, so...
Daryl needs to see The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
He does. Everybody needs to see it. It's great.
That's in his wheelhouse.
I don't know. I mean, if Daryl liked the Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr., then he would probably like this.
Well,
I mean, it's in the
it's
same...
It's a ton better than those.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of got this European, Euro-punk, I don't know what
it
is.
Well, it's a 60s movie. It's a aura. At least it's a period piece.
It is, and it is, and it's got a very European flair, but it's very distinctive.
Yep.
It's very funny. It's very dry. Henry Cavill, I didn't expect to like him in anything after that just really bland performance he gave as Superman, which, to be fair, I don't think was his fault. But, yeah, I mean, they should just stop making Superman films, period, and make a dozen of these. Yeah, that was that. It's The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I don't think we could really fit it into our heist film framework, but it's definitely a pretty lighthearted spy movie,
yeah,
as compared to, say, Bond, or you know, it's much more in the Mission Impossible type thing. But with
did you like
with
it better than
style.
This? Did you like it better than Rogue Nation?
I don't know. I mean, I think that both of those movies are movies that I liked a lot initially, and then I watched them a few more times, and I'm like, okay, you know, I think they're different. They have slightly different approaches. This one is much more character-driven to some extent, but at the same time, they also, I think, paper over a lot of... There's nothing happening in this scene, so we're just going to play a lot of music and be very stylish. So a lot of it is style over substance, which is kind of great. It's a lot of fun that way. But Rogue Nation, for instance, was the centerpiece was Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise, you know, just giving this powerhouse performance with the stunts and with all that going on. And and it was well plotted. It was well written. I don't think that this movie is quite... I think that it's funnier, but I think the plotting is not quite as good. So I think that they excel in different areas, really. I think that is what I would say. They both had, I will mention, they both had really, really good heroines. Rebecca Ferguson in Mission Impossible and Alicia Vikander in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And I hope they make another one, because that was just a lot of fun.
It made
for a nice change from the much more grim fare that you tended to get, especially last year, like with Mad Max and everything, which I liked, but, you know, you needed a breather. That's like... It's the most action film ever, It's not maybe not the best action film, but it's the most action film. Anyway, okay, we were talking about the Lady Killers. I'd put down The Wrong Trousers too, which is a heist film. I grew up watching Wallace and Gromit, so yeah, that's nostalgia for me.
And Poirot.
Play animation.
Yeah. Yeah, those were good, and The Wrong Trousers was probably the only heist film that's ever been made, which is about a penguin, or should I say a chicken, trying to break in and steal some sort of diamond, I think. But yeah, that would fall under the just desserts genre, too, because the bad guy gets what's his in the end, and Wallace and Gromit are okay.
Are they so, both Nick Parks?
Nick Park, I think.
Park?
Yeah. So, anyway, the next genre would be, I probably wouldn't even classify as heist films, but again, we're talking about anti-heroes, and that's sort of the descent into darkness genre, which is the ones which not only take the person's sin seriously, as the Reformation genre does, but it also doesn't offer them any redemption, as, you know, like the just desserts genre. So it's both serious and it doesn't offer any redemption, any way out. So you have The Godfather. I would put The Godfather into that, which is a tragedy. It's about you're supposed to kind of root for the anti-hero, but at the same time you're watching them just sink into the mire at the same time. And so that would be Fargo, I think, which is another Coen Brothers film, which is very dark, but it's about this kind of really selfish businessman played by William Macy, who is trying to embezzle some money, I think, from his father-in-law by having these guys kidnap his wife and hold her for hostage. But something goes wrong, and everything goes wrong, and it's one thing after another after another. The great thing about that movie, though, was the heroine, Marge Gunderson. She was great. Oh yeah.
Was it funny?
It was funny in a really dark way. You know, it in a very dark way, but it was also quite moral. You know, you had to look for it, but it was just the Coen Brothers, I think, have this real ability to make awful people funny and almost sympathetic. You know, none of their characters are perfect people, really. I mean, Marge Gunderson is probably the closest you get. They're all flawed, and they make you really like these flawed people. Like from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you had George Clooney's character, who was hilarious, but he was definitely very flawed. So I think that they more than anybody really make you like ordinary people. But yeah, that type of thing. We've only gotten 40 minutes in, but I knew I hadn't written enough for this one. But there's only so much you can say about anti-heroes anyway.
Well, that's true.
Well, I haven't.
We're not, you know, criminals at heart, so we can't sympathize with the criminal element in our midst.
I thought you were a Calvinist.
Calvinists are criminals?
Well, you see, they're just more totally depraved than everybody else.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Well, you see.
Well, yeah, I think people like to see, you know. Well, I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, because a lot of people do still like Robin Hood. You know, they like to see, you know, some people get their comeuppance. They don't really stop to think about whether it's deserved or not. You know,
yeah,
they just like to see it happen, and particularly if they're, you know, perceived as bad moral characters, then they think, it's, you know, they deserve it. They had it coming.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important how films and the stories we tell handle villains and vengeance and justice and all those sort of things. For instance, you know, I am infamously not a fan of Braveheart, because I think that it handles it very clumsily in a sort of fairy tale kind of way, where all the bad guys are really bad and all the good guys are really good. And it would be one thing if it was something rather whimsical like Waking Ned Divine, in which you're not taking really anybody very seriously, and you also can laugh at the heroes occasionally, at their foibles. But Braveheart is just completely serious about everything. I mean, it's just like, oh, his wife has been killed by these evil Englishmen. Don't you hate them? Oh, the English have killed the innocent people. The English have done this. The Longshanks even kills his son's buddy. You know what I mean?
I don't think it's his buddy.
Yeah, well, there is...
This is a politically correct show.
Well, I was trying to approach that when I'm like, okay, how am I going to phrase this? And I'm like, okay, this is a family podcast.
That's
well,
right.
I'm
behind you, Hannah.
Well, there was a deleted 100%. Scene in Braveheart which kind of explained that.
Really?
Yeah, there was. And you,
ooh.
Yeah, he wasn't his buddy. Or he was his buddy. But let's just move on.
I think that's a grand idea.
Anyway, but Braveheart just takes that all so seriously, and you've got to hate the villains completely, and that there is no redemption there whatsoever, and there is no ability to think critically about the heroes either. It's just, you know, and because you identify with the heroes, then you feel it's kind of there's just no self-criticism there, and it's just very clumsy.
I agree with that. I mean, it's an emotional ride, and more than anything else. It's vengeance is, you want to see. I mean, it's like all those movies, like any Bond movie. Well, you want to see the bad guy.
Well, yeah.
Is the bad guy? You want to see him get what's coming to him.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what Braveheart does. I mean, it.
Yeah, I don't mind emotional movies, but I do mind manipulative movies that are going to manipulate you with unfair and unlikely situations to make you really hate, just really blatant attempts to do that, and then paper it over with platitudes about, well, William Wallace was fighting for freedom, and he just happened to have an affair with a princess at the time.
Well, I was just wondering about that point. Was that a point that was not true that they just added?
Let's put it this way. Basically, nothing in Braveheart is at all
true to fact.
I highly doubt it. I mean, I understand that Longshanks was kind of a nice fella that, gave to charity a lot. But I don't know. I mean, it doesn't feel at all like a true story. It feels like something that's made up to drum up your emotions at the right moment. And, that's all well and good, I guess, but... Well, no, it isn't.
Make Scotland great again.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it's about.
I just find it much more satisfying when it isn't, when it feels like a true story instead of something that's manipulative.
Well, when it came out, though, I think it was so different and so unexpected. I mean, and I could be wrong about this, I probably am, but the battle scenes in that
mm-hmm.
were so brutal and so realistic. That I think up to that point, a lot of that had, they'd have sword fights or whatever, but, some guy would stumble off with an arm and, a
yeah.
sword under his arm, right?
Yeah.
And so, but this took it to a different level, and it was very realistic, and guys especially were like, yeah, that's what it was really like.
I remember watching it and thinking I might have nightmares because, it was very...
And I think that is why.
That's the way it was. That's very, very, very. That part, I think, even though I'm sure it was still, you could argue about that too. I mean, back in ancient times, they would, like at Cannes, when Hannibal fought Scipio, I think it was, there was like 50,000 guys that died in one afternoon. I mean, and they didn't die with artillery and with guns, it was with very crude weapons.
Right.
And I mean, it takes a lot of effort to kill 50,000 men.
The part on the battlefields didn't bother me as much as when William Wallace went to get the guys, the nobles that were supposed to stand with him, and you'd see them you know, riding up into their bedchamber with the ball and chain where he was going to crush
yeah.
their skull.
Well, I mean, and that's the problem I have with it, though. It would be one thing if it was just kind of a lark, but the movie takes itself so seriously, it says, this is realism, this is what it was really
yeah.
like. You know, and it's warfare is mature, but it's emotional, situational, plot, its ideas are all very immature. So it's a movie that's not mature enough to handle the violence. So as compared to Henry V, which has violence which is nearly as graphic, it's quite graphic, but it also has a story which is mature enough to counterbalance that. You know, it's not just, I think that that's a much more satisfying movie on all levels because...
Oh yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think if you compare it to The Dirty Dozen or to, you know, what's it, Inglourious Basterds, right? Or some of those others, I mean, is that it, you know, it, we need some bad guys. Who could we use in the past 100 years to be really, really bad guys?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that those films are any better, though. I would say that Pulp Fiction is a much more intelligently written movie than Braveheart.
That it's not fair to pick on Braveheart completely on that score, because that's what filmmakers do, is they play to people's emotions and their...
Well, that's what bad filmmakers do.
Well...
I mean, I don't know about that. Well, what I mean is, you know, I think that Braveheart, you know, and I'm not denying that it has good qualities... It's just that it could have been a better movie. And I'm not saying that it's the end-all be-all of bad movies. I'm just picking on it. The Patriot, for instance, is worse. You know, so
I agree with that.
I just want to go on record for saying that I liked William and Murren's romance, you know, their relationships very much.
Yeah,
the romance there. Now, they could have gone without the pornographic scene, but other than that, I liked, I liked how he kept the flower, you know, that she'd given him all those years, and the romance behind that. Now, I did not like that he was unfaithful to her memory with the princess, which they, you know, obviously added there. So, I just felt like I needed to say that.
Okay. Well, anyway, yeah, I've had my little Braveheart rant. We already talked about The Godfather, though.
We didn't talk enough about The Godfather.
Well, we did do a whole podcast on The Godfather, though.
Oh,
but
well,
that
I wasn't
was,
in it.
That was, okay, well, we should talk about it with you then. We need to watch the third part. Bethel has been telling me that I need to watch that, even though she says it's not great, but we should watch it. I started it some time ago, but I didn't finish it. It's kind of bizarre, but anyway... we talked about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., right? Yeah, we did.
Briefly.
Yeah, that was a fun movie.
That's a blast.
I really liked Armie Hammer, too, which is possibly the most macho name for a guy ever, Armie Hammer.
Yeah, he really did a good job. And the other guy, what's his name?
Cavill, yeah, Henry Cavill.
They just worked well together. I thought it was really funny, and it was just tremendously uplifting to see one of these kind of James Bond films, because it showed them making mistakes and silly things that they did, and, you know, trying to work together when they so obviously would rather work alone, you know. So it was really a lot of fun. I enjoyed it very much.
And Guy Ritchie is really good at those, you know, couple of guys, buddy comedy type thing, you know, buddy adventure film. You know, that really doesn't work for women as much, does it? I was thinking the other day that you have a lot of these great kind of male friendships on screen and on the stories, but you really don't get that with women as much. I mean, you have Pride and Prejudice. I mean, that's a good one, and Diana and Shirley and Anne of Green Gables, but
mm-hmm.
there just aren't as many good examples of that. And I, you know,
good examples of what?
Like female friendship, just in stories. I think that of the level of loyalty that you get between these kind of iconic pairings, like Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and
bro films,
Dr. Maturin and Aubrey, Stephen Aubrey. And then you have, like, you know, Jonathan Mardukas and Jack Walsh and Midnight Run, and you have Hot Fuzz, and you have just all these, you know, all that, you know, Wooster and Jeeves.
Thelma and Louise.
Yeah, I'd say I was going to mention that, but, yeah.
It's a complete waste of time.
I just want to go on record and say that Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is one of the funniest movies that I have ever seen. I just really enjoyed it, and, you know, Steve Martin's
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Humor in that
There's
was
another,
hilarious.
You know.
When he was the brother, Ruprecht.
I think it's hard to beat Midnight Run for buddy movies, though.
Waking Ned Devine's better.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's
yeah,
but you, but Dad thinks that
buddy.
It's the best. It's
it
the,
is in all genres.
It's the best movie of all genres. It's a better war movie than
it's
Braveheart.
It's a better war movie. It's better than Hamlet.
Well, it's a better movie set in Ireland, Scotland area than Braveheart is. Yes. Starring a Scottish actor in the main role. Anyway, though, we better wrap it up.
We made it.
Yeah, what should we talk about next time? I haven't thought about it because I've been busy with school stuff.
I don't know.
We'll come up with something.
We'll come up with something. We're open to ideas from the listening audience too. But, we'll come up with something.
Well, in the meantime, and we'll be playing our Waking Ned Devine theme music, which is normally our exit music, but we've been playing other stuff for the last few weeks. Well, last few podcasts, rather. We'll be back to our...
You got to tell your story about that right quick.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, actually, I can also say that Bethel sent me this soundtrack, so thanks, Bethel. Otherwise, we had kind of a scratchy version of it, The Parting Glass. Well, it was a few years ago, and... I was playing with the Irish band that I was a part of at the time, and we were at a pub, and the listening audience had, you know, let's just say they were well lubricated at this point in the evening, and they were singing along to, I think, Leonard Cohen at the time, and so I was sitting out, and this guy walks up to me, and he says, "Hey," he says, "do you know anything by Loreena McKennitt?" And I'm like, "No," he says, "we're anything from Waking Ned Devine." And there was just sort of this moment where, like, this kind of the clouds parted and light came down, and I said, "Yes, I do." And he hands me $10, and I'm like, "I can play as much as you want. I'll play the whole soundtrack. I will deliver Jackie's eulogy from memory. I mean, I can do that." But he told me that his daughter, they'd just gotten out of a funeral, and that she was really quite depressed, and that they loved that movie, and could I play something from it? And I'm like, "Yes, yes, I can. It will be difficult, but I will force myself. Thank you for that $10. And so I grabbed my violin, and I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on here, but I'm a violinist. And I stood up, and, you know, I told the lead singer of our band, Denise, I said, "Hey, you know," and I actually happened to be the only person in the band who knew anything about Waking Ned Devine, because I'd discussed it with them before. I'd said, "Hey, you ever seen this movie?" And they're like, "No." So, I was the only one. And so I played that, everything went quiet, and I broke out The Parting Glass and started playing it and walked across the room to their table, and, you know, and then they just, that was, I will admit, one of my great moments, because I brought the house down.
Magic house.
I mean, it was like the one song I knew. I mean, of all the movies that you would ask me about, it would be the one where I knew the theme song by heart on my violin and could play it at the drop of a hat. So that was a pretty great moment.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was epic.
And I got money. And that's always good. So, anyway, I guess we had better wrap it up. And I have been neglecting this section of the podcast. So, if you want to find us online, any new listeners, which, I mean, we never have new listeners, we are on Twitter. Grove Boy and Longish are on Twitter. And we also have Pilgrim's Podcast Twitter. And then we're on Facebook in several locations. And we've got a email address, which we never use, thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. You can send your comments there. You can comment on the blog. We'll read your comments on the air and respond to them. So, yeah, that's it. I think that's pretty much the lineup.
Excellent.
In the meantime, I don't have an exit line, but I always have an escape plan.
Money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and all the harm I've ever done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be to you all.